Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from North or South, or from the East or West? My heart is filled with love for all of thee. I only know I swell with pride, and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze.
Goals. I think we've got a lot of runs on the board, to use your expression.
we took some short-term goals, and they were the geriatric program in the hospital at Caulfield, and that's become known internationally. I
mean, Caulfield's in Australia.
Yes, it is, in Victoria. And it's certainly even better known abroad than it is in Australia. It's been a great success. And it's a dog-in-residence campaign. Honey, the dog, lives there. The important thing about that is no matter how you evaluate it as a success, one way of proving that to you would be to say that there are now 100 hospitals in Australia with dog-in-residence programs under evaluation.
Now, when you say dog-in-hospital, do you mean a separate ward or wing?
No, these hospitals are what you call geriatric extended care hospitals.
And we call them nursing homes.
Right. And the horse, the dog lives there, comes in the morning, goes out at night at 8 o'clock. About 30 patients per ward. The dog's a guide dog that wasn't any good at being a guide dog. She's called Honey. She wasn't any good at being a guide dog because she didn't like traffic noise.
Doctor, would you say, since women seem to live longer than men for whatever reason, that women tend to have pets and more, you know, since they live more, longer rather, and a lot of women, at least in America, tend to exclude or diminish the human relationship, the interaction with other human beings. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. We addressed it on Nightline. I did the other night for an hour. What you're saying is that, in fact, they're using pets in a surrogate way, or as a substitute for. I don't think it's right.
What's the question, or what they're doing?
I don't think the interpretation is right. I recognize, well, I don't have a judgmental position on what they're doing. It's just what they do. I mean, it's there, and that's fact. Let me tell you why I think I'm doubtful as to that explanation, and it's an interesting question. One is, if the pet wasn't there, what would they do? Can you assume that they'd automatically redirect that effort towards the husband? I think the answer is no. In a positive sense, it can often be a useful emotional outlet where there would be nothing. So the argument gets pretty thin. For example, we had a woman ring in on Nightline who said that she was aggressive to her husband and her son, but she loved them very much, but she could show her affection to her animals.
Well, what about the people who are widowed and don't have any family or immediate family, or they've been discarded, which often happens, and then they get a pet?
Yeah, I think that I would see that more as a halfway house. I think they get a pet for immediate companionship, and likewise a woman rang in on that sort of situation. And I think that's it's a stepping stone to meeting other human beings, if you like. And I don't think it's even unreasonable on the pet, because if they do, for example, supposing they have immediately after grief, in the grief stage, they have a companion animal, they get a poodle, for example, to make it right down to grassroots stuff. They have the poodle, it fulfills that immediate need, there's no doubt about that. Ultimately, they will either decide that that's enough and they don't want to get married again and they just keep their continuing contacts at a distance, or they'll socialise more fully and perhaps marry again. Now, the pet has served a useful purpose in the short term. If that happens, we advise them to get a second pet so that the little dog isn't left out on the limb when he's replaced with a human being. But either way you look at it, I think they're coming out ahead.
You brought up grief. Doctor, when a person loses a pet and there's a strong emotional attachment, is there any formula that you people have worked out or researched that how soon after the death of the pet that they should get another one? Should they get the same type, or should they just forget about a pet, or is it an individual situation that you prescribe according to the dictates of the situation?
I think there's some general comments you can make, although there is an individual component. If they've had a pet, then they're committed to the whole business of a human companion. So I think the answer is, if they've had one that's died, get a replacement one as soon as you like. pardon me, the other piece of advice is that if the pet is old and they say to you, look, I'm worried, his heart's bad and he's going to die, then the advice is, before the event, get a second pet. That does two things. It eases that period we're talking about. And the second thing is, it's amazing what a young pup will do to an old dog. I mean, it just brightens up the whole bag of tricks.
Should it be the same sex?
Well, I haven't got any sexual hang-ups up either way.
I'm talking about the dog doctor.
I don't think it matters a great deal, and of course we advocate fairly strongly de-sexing anyway, so I don't think it's a component.
But wouldn't there be territorial problems?
Yes, there are. But I think you've got to recognize in this old dog situation, the dog is becoming less able to defend its territory, and young animals are very flexible, so he will keep trying his territorial on infringement on the older dog, and they'll work out some sort of deal. You know.
Can that extend to cats?
It's a totally different business. You can't do a simple jump and say that the bond between dogs and human beings is the same as cats. Cats are more independent, much more of a one-way street in many instances. And of course, I think people have different expectations out of cats. And you can certainly introduce a second cat, and if you're committed to them, I think that's a useful thing to do.
You wouldn't get an alley cat, would you?
No, too rough on the carpet.
Some of these feral cats I've heard about here in Australia. Doctor, I heard you are involved in prison work with pets. Is that so?
Only to a slight degree. We are aware of the fact that in the prison, certainly in Victoria, the state of Victoria where I come from, prisons are kept on an unofficial basis. And I think that's wrong. I think they're there, they're seen by the prisoners and the staff to be useful. Why not bring it out in the open and say this is part of the program? Because there are almost too many things to be done, we settle for the hospital program and this kids' educational program. But we'd like to have a look at prisons. I think prisons are a more tricky exercise. You've got to profile a pet better. You've got to decide what's the most suitable pet. And there have been some programs that have gone off the rails, and I wouldn't want to repeat those.
Are there any other prisons in Australia or New Zealand that are doing allowing prisoners to have pets?
Not that I'm aware. There's certainly a women's prison in Victoria. I ought to be fair, mention that there is a low security prison in Victoria which allows the prisoners to train the guide dogs. And that's a useful role for the prisoners. The townspeople in this low security prison, they know that they're prisoners by the fact that they've got a guide dog on their lead and they're training.
What are the benefits of prisoners having pets?
Well, I think it's the first thing is loneliness, isn't it? Isolation, sense of isolation. I mean, there are many, many stories. You know, and I think you can also use them, I suppose, in a therapeutic way. There's one story around that, a guy who's convicted for multiple murder. Right, you put him in solitary confinement. There's not much else you can do to him. I mean, he's there for life. He's got no prospect of getting out. And some of those people, when I've been in prison, have... are pretty antisocial. They bust the place up. Now, this particular chap had a small, I think it was a bird, actually. And the only way they could control that guy and stop him from being so violent was to threaten to take the bird away. And he used to say to them, you can't do anything else to me. I'm here for life. No one comes and sees me. I'm in isolation anyway. You can't do anything else. But they said, yes, we can take the bird away. Whenever they did, he behaved himself. I mean, it was a means of getting at him.
So this means of social control, could this be extended to other prisoners in other prison situations, given the program was worked out?
I'm sure it could, but I think the key is be selective. And I know there's some programs in the country you come from that have gone off the rails, where the prisoners have actually... people who are very seriously disturbed have in fact damaged the animals, and that's what I'd be against.
If you were talking to your opposite number and say you were talking to an American prison official or people who were considering or would entertain the idea of having pets as a therapeutic tool, what practical advice would you offer them, Doctor?
Firstly, decide what categories of prisoners need the most and if they're suitable. The second thing to decide is what sort of companion animals are suitable. Now, when I was in Pentridge, birds were kept, and they seemed very, that little budgerigars flying around. But of course, I'm talking about the low security prisons. I can't right now see an opportunity. We have a prison in Victoria called Jaika Jaika, and I've been through it. That's the top security prison. Now, there was in the exercise yard, when the day before I'd been there, one prisoner had strangled another. and done the job before they get the doors open to reverse the process. Now, I wouldn't want to expose an animal to that sort of risk in an innocent sense, and I just don't quite know how to tackle that. So I'd have a question mark about whether it's applicable there.
So each individual situation will have to be assessed individually.
And I think the starting point is start with the low security part. And of course, I think also animals are a socializing process, and they can be a halfway house. And in low security, people are going to get out of that prison. Why not help build up their confidence in their confidence in their contacts by starting off with a companion animal in that situation, and then they can take the budgerigar out of prison with them and begin to get back into the community.
So you're suggesting what I would call low maintenance pets like birds
right.
and fish.
Yes, I think that's right. Because there are, I saw cats in this prison, this low security part. It's much more of a managerial problem, and dogs are more of a managerial problem, unless you do what we did in Caulfield, which was share the dog. You know, one dog to 90 people is not a big load, but 90 dogs to 90 people is quite a problem.
Right. Thank you, Doctor, for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
This is Peter Paul down here in Perth talking to Dr. Sterling Hogarth Scott. I get it in there. Oh, I know.
Now from pets to insurance. One of the big political fictions is that you can't buy insurance across state lines. Well, those of you who have a vehicle and who should have auto or truck insurance, look at the home office of the insurance company whose policy that you hold and who has insured you. If you have Allstate, their home office, corporate office is in Illinois. I believe it's in Northbrook. If you have Hartford or Travelers, it's probably in Connecticut. There are other companies across the country, nationwide. I don't know where the one on the web is. But auto insurance is sold across state lines. It's one of the big political fictions. So I don't know where they get this political, what I call political diversion about insurance is not sold across state lines. It is sold across state lines. All you got to do is look at your auto insurance policy. Excuse me, I still got a cold. One of the things that came up in the Steve Neri case, the U.S. Navy sailor, we're going into 16 years of one of the biggest cover-ups in American judicial and jurisprudence, judicial history, how local courts openly defied federal jurisdiction and authority over federal military personnel. In this case, it was removed. What that means is, since they didn't have jurisdiction, only the military can grant jurisdiction to a local, to the state, who in turn grants it to the local court when a federal military person is accused of crimes against local civilian authority or state authority. There's a procedure in the Code of Federal Regulations in Book 32 for the Navy people. It's subsection 720.6, and it's up on our Free the Sailor website. You can go to that and look at the document there, and we'll put up the document that was forged by a at-will employee in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office in March of 1996. And this was censored and suppressed by our legacy press, the Chronicle, the Examiner, so, and, of course, the Homosexual Prostitution Press, which published some libelous comments about the case, and a lot of it was untrue. It was willful behavior on the part of these homosexuals who were themselves involved in male prostitution and video voyeurism, which is well documented in this case. But anyway, what happened was, after Kevin Ryan, who himself may have been an illegal alien. He lied. He perjured himself on federal, not federal, but when he ran for judge in the San Francisco court system, San Francisco County, on his papers, sworn statements, he said, "I lived all my life in San Francisco." However, when an Israeli military-connected source investigated Ryan, we found his marriage certificate, marriage of convenience, which said he was born in Alberta, Canada, in 1957, I believe. This is a certified document also. And yet this is an example of perjury. Not only that, after the case was removed, one of the judges in the case gave me, since I was the legal liaison between the Navy and Stephen Neary, gave me a copy of the names of the jurors. When we checked out the jurors, at least one of them may not have been a U.S. citizen. In fact, she already owned a house. She was involved in shady real estate dealings and got $25,000 from a HUD-funded program run through the city to buy a second property. And then another woman, an Iranian lesbian named Motamed, who surfaced in the gay-lesbian marriage circus that was held at City Hall, she was involved at our nuclear facility in Livermore Lab. Serious questions about this lesbian, whether she is in this country legally or not. And there may have been another one. But what's going on, and this is reported in one of the legal papers, that in New Mexico, I think it was New Mexico, we'll get the document again or the clipping from the news article, that they were allowing in one county non-English-speaking people on the juries. And, of course, some of them may have not even been U.S. citizens or in this country legally. And this is what's going on. They came up with this outrageous rule in San Francisco where you could not ask a person who was called for a jury. And if they're called for a jury, then they're on the voter registration rolls or driver's license registration. That doesn't mean they're in the country legally. Anyway, when they poll the prospective jurors, one of the questions they could not ask or would not or not allowed to ask, even though it's illegal restriction, was, are they U.S. citizens? So what happened, in this New Mexico county, somebody raised the question, and the article was published. Excuse me. So this is something we got to worry about. Next week we're going to have, General MacArthur, in his farewell address to Congress, it was a long address. The last part, he deals with a worldwide turmoil and what the United States should do. Of course, this was over 60 years ago, but it's still relevant today, especially with what appears to be a civil war that's erupting in Egypt and will probably spread. So that'll be featured Friday. We will also have another one of our interviews that we did. This one was done, I think, I've done interviews in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States, primarily in California, with Dr. Michael Fox, who is also, he's English. He's an animal behaviorist. He's an expert on wolves and dogs, so we'll have his interview. And then probably next Wednesday, one of the best real political journalists in Illinois, Patrick Butler, who I also knew for years, used to run around on a police beat with him, taught me some things. He'll be featured and be talking about what I call real politics, the practice in Chicago, as compared to what I call the crotch politics or pansy politics that is appearing so much in so many places out here in California. So that'll be next week, and we will have other interviews. I've got over 1,500, and we're still going through them and transferring them from tape to CD and onto the World Wide Web. We'll be updating our Amicus Veritas YouTube sites. Excuse me. since we got a little time here, and I unfortunately had a little problem, I couldn't get to February 2nd. Why don't we just... What shall we play today? I like Will Rogers. I'll play Will Rogers because what's happened in Congress today, apparently the word is, as expected, the Republicans didn't have enough votes to overturn Obamacare, but this battle's going to go on. So too bad if Will Rogers was living today. I wonder what he'd say, but let's hear what he had to say in the past. What's the matter here? What happened to Will Rogers? I don't don't know what happened here on the, shame on me. Well, let's see what else we got.
It is in this country there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know? That's the main problem today, is who hands out the presents. Here he says he should wear the whiskers. And it is, and Mr. Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. It's been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know. More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nut should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans. That's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what it is. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more heat plume arms out of little red schoolhouses.
I'm going to cut it off there early. So we'll end with our usual theme, which is what politics is about today. Too bad they don't play poker over in Egypt. Where is politics and poker? Oh, here we go.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going
to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
I suppose we should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bet out.
Politics and poker, shuffle up and cards and find the joker. He's a game for children, he's a game is rough. Decisions like
who to pick,
how to play, how to bet,
when to call a bluff.
All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Parrot raise.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fajicinkovich. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davy's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Okay,
Frank
folks,
ain't a citizen,
night.
And George is in jail.
Okay, so we'll be back Friday at 5 o'clock. It's Peter Paul Brizola. Good night. Thank you.